We Made This.
Hey everyone, this is Tony, Network Chief of We Made This. As you know, our podcast network brings together a brilliant assortment of talent who talk about all kinds of pop culture content, such as the episode you've just listened to, or you're just about to listen to. We'd love to keep the lights on a bit longer if you're able to support our network on Patreon. For just £2 a month, you get your name in lights on the website and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping us produce more great audio. And for £3 a month, you'll get your name in lights, but you'll also get access to an exclusive bi-monthly podcast from the We Made This talent pool on podcasting, pop culture, and you tell us. We'll take your suggestions. For less than the price of a coffee per month, you can help keep We Made This going. So just head to patreon.com/WeMadeThis. That's patreon.com/WeMadeThis to get the ball rolling. Now, back to your scheduled programming. Welcome back everyone to the XCast. The truth is in here. I'm your host, Tony Black, and in this latest Patreon roundtable, we're going to be starting a brand new long-form recurring series looking at the titles of the X-Files episodes and unpicking the deeper meanings, themes, and ideas within them. And we're going to start in this episode with the titles from season one. And joining me for the beginning of this odyssey are two of our regular patrons, recurring guest, Eleanor Butler, and brand new contributor, Jonas Wilstrup. Guys, welcome. It's great to have you on the XCast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you. It's a great pleasure to be allowed to join this.
Well, Jonas, this is your first go on the XCast roundtables, and it's really nice to finally speak to you. We've had plenty of discussions on the basement and on messages and things like that. So yeah, where are you hailing from today? And why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about you?
I am from the country of Denmark. I live in Denmark in Copenhagen. Yeah, living basically in the center of the city. I'm 45 years old, working in tech at the moment, but a lifelong geek and a big lover of everything science fiction. And X-Files has been part of my life basically ever since a couple of years into its run. Yeah, been listening to your podcast for quite some time and thoroughly enjoyed it and decided to become a patron a while back.
Yeah, well, firstly, thank you for that. Thank you for becoming a patron and supporting the show. That is massively appreciated. And yeah, it's great that you've been listening so long and that you're such a fan. I have to say, I genuinely have always wanted to go to Copenhagen and Denmark generally, because Eddie lives in Britain. I'm sure she'll agree that anywhere's better than here, and Denmark looks like, especially right now, and Denmark has always seemed like a really lovely country full of very nice people. So Copenhagen must be a great place to live.
Yeah, well, my former job actually before I went into tech was to work with the tourism board of Copenhagen. So I'm of course very happy you say that, because my job was basically to get people to come here. So if you get me started, I'll nerd about Copenhagen for many, many, many hours, but I won't bore you with that. But certainly you should come.
Well, now I know I've got a personal tour guide, I'm there, to be fair.
Exactly. Sorted. X-Cast meetup.
Certainly. Certainly. If you ever come, you should reach out. I know some tips. Well, even though when you've had a job like that, people always expect you to know everything. So then this becomes quite embarrassing sometimes when you realize, actually, I don't.
Well, don't worry. With us, we'd be nodding at everything you said, going, oh, wow, okay, you could tell us anything. You could lie.
Yeah, I guess.
Ellie, then, how have you been? It's been a while since we last spoke. How's life with you?
Yeah, life is good. Just trying to squeeze out the last bits of summer. It's sunny where I am now. It's a bit windy. We're about to go on holiday to Cornwall like the rest of the country. So fingers crossed for some good weather.
Yeah, that is something we were planning to go camping, myself and my wife, in Cornwall. It's not going to happen now, but you're right. Everyone goes, yeah, let's go to Cornwall. We can't go. Every other country in the planet, quite wisely, has gone, do not let Plague Island in. So we're all going to Cornwall, basically.
But I feel like everyone in England, now that we are just exploring, you know, the UK, everyone's like, oh, actually, it's really beautiful here. It's like we didn't know before.
Oh, yeah, we do have lovely stuff. To be fair, we do. If anyone is listening to this not in the UK, there are some really nice places. And Cornwall particularly is gorgeous in the summer when the weather's good. So there are beaches to rival like Spain or the Mediterranean. So yeah, well, I hope you enjoy. Definitely. But before Ellie dashes off on her holidays and Jonas does a few more tours around Copenhagen, we better talk some X-Files, I think. So we're going to talk about the titles. Now, this idea came from another podcast I do about Star Trek called Primitive Culture. Some of you listening to this may have come across that in the past. But myself and my co-host on that, Duncan Barrett, we did, well, it wasn't all me, there were a couple of other people involved, but we did a long-form series looking at the titles of all 800 episodes of Star Trek. Now, that is a mammoth task. And to be fair, not quite a lot of the titles you could skim over. And it was particularly zoning in on the more interesting titles. But it took 7 podcasts to do it. And I think Duncan expected to do it in far fewer. But it took a long, long time. So that's why I'm aware this is going to be more of a long-form thing. And we're hoping to get through the first 2 seasons, so that's 48, 49 episodes. But again, there are certain episodes we can just skip over a little bit and focus in. So I think this is going to be really interesting. As soon as we did this quite successful title podcast on Primitive Culture, I thought this would be great for the X-Files. So, I mean, generally, guys, do you think, based on thinking about some of these titles, do you think the X-Files has a fair bit to sort of chew on here that maybe hasn't been extensively covered?
Personally, when we came up with the theme, I was thinking, oh, won't that be hard? It will be, I mean, a challenge. I was immediately thinking about episode titles like Fire or Space, or great episodes, by the way, Space not. But when I sat down and did the research preparing for this, I found tons of stuff in there. I actually think it's a fairly meaty subject, and I actually think there are some really good titles in there. That's my personal view.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think what I enjoyed is trying to look at a title that seems abstract, or maybe even some of the ones that are named after songs or pop culture references and stuff, and then looking at the overlap of themes in the actual episode themselves. So yeah, I think there's going to be a lot to discuss.
Yeah, I think so. I've been a bit surprised in doing some research on this as well and thinking, oh, wow, okay, like, didn't expect that, or that's, you know. And some of the, to be fair, on some of the previous XCast episodes, there have been discussions on titles. We have gone into it at points, but I think it's quite interesting to sort of, and not everyone will have always remembered that anyway, so it's quite interesting to sort of condense it and put them all into one episode or a few episodes as we go. So this will be, I think, quite fun, and hopefully we will unpick a few things that we haven't heard before. So let's start then with season one. I'm going to start with Deep Throat because that one is a second episode, obviously. The pilot is always, you know, it's pilot. We know what that means. Loads of shows at that time were called pilot. That's become a bit less common these days. But Deep Throat obviously has a particular resonance beyond the character of Deep Throat. So it's on multiple levels, I think, this title. So we've got Deep Throat, the character, and then we've got Deep Throat, the source material, don't we, of where that character came from?
We do. And I think that goes back to how the X-Files draws from kind of 70s culture and 70s style storytelling. And here we have 70s events, if my history knowledge doesn't fail me. And so I think maybe in the 90s, when those events were only 20 years old, people would have made that connection a lot more clearly than maybe that particular name, you know, new viewers to the show now who are experiencing it for the first time and who are maybe in their early 20s and so on. I think that particular connection is less obvious now than it was maybe in the show's original run.
Because it refers specifically to the pseudonym of the person who helped expose the Watergate scandal, which obviously was a massive touchstone for the X-Files, which Chris Carter has talked about, which in brief was the taped robbery at the Watergate Hotel in 1972 that brought down President Nixon, essentially caused him to resign before he could be impeached, or he might have been impeached. I can't quite remember, but either one. That the pseudonym of Deep Throat was the person who gave the information to Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, who wrote the expose about this, and that subsequently became the film All the President's Men, which was very popular in the 1970s, and again was a touchstone for the X-Files. And then it was exposed years later who Deep Throat was. It was a guy called Mark Felt. He worked for the FBI, which is, again, another X-Files tie. And he was the guy who leaked everything. So, I mean, it's a big touchstone for the X-Files to go for, to call them informant Deep Throat, isn't it? I mean, is it too on the nose, almost, to actually, like you said, Ellie, at the time, people would have remembered the Deep Throat name, even if at that time they didn't know who it was. Mark Felt. That came out decades later. Was it a bit too obvious?
It is very obvious in a way, but it's also a very fine and direct tie to what's going on in the actual episode, which is such a strong episode. So to me, I've always liked that title so much, because I think it connects so directly into what's actually going on there. And it's not, it is a bit, very direct, but I think also very meaningful, at least for the episode in question. I mean, I do think about the title, the Deep Throat. I think it's an excellent point that the 90s was closer. And I think especially also considering it is an American show, I think for Americans, the whole Watergate scandal is such a pivotal political event, right? Whereas where I sat, that when I saw this episode the first time, being in my early 20s, unfortunately, I think my connotations were something differently. I didn't have enough knowledge at that point about American history. So I was like, why is this episode named this? But I found out, and it makes perfect sense, I think, and it is a bit on the nose.
It's not too on the nose, because it's the title of the episode, isn't it? So if you were just watching this, like if it was on the BBC back in the day, there's nowhere that it says Deep Throat in the credits or anything like that. And Mulder he's not like, hey, I've got this informant. Or maybe he is, but he doesn't like say, okay, I've got this Deep Throat shadowy character. So it's kind of like it's the name of the title to suggest the relationship. And then the story goes off fairly quickly into the story of, Colonel Budahas and stuff. So it is on the nose, but they don't reference it in the episode as such. So it's, I really like it. I think it sets up the atmosphere as long as you know the context.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's only in later episodes, I think, that he does start to call him my deep throat source, essentially. And then it becomes a bit more of a common thing between Mulder and Scully. But it is, you're right, though, in that people will instantly know the meaning. And I think at that time, and I think as people who weren't born or lived in America when we were young, I think, and were born after the fact, I think, it would have taken a bit longer and a bit more of that historical context to know that than maybe American audiences. But yeah, I think it's good. I think it's interesting how it's drawing on a real life source as well, a real life name, a very famous informant, one of the most infamous informants in American history, if not the most famous. So yeah, I think it's interesting how X-Files definitely intersects with that. I mean, there's probably some headcanon that actually the character of Deep Throat, Jerry Hardin's character, was Mark Felt.
Yeah.
And it's the same guy.
Yeah.
But I know the show, his name's Ronald, I think, in the show in the end. But like, yeah. But no, it was very interesting. Mark Felt came out with this in 2005, a few years before his death. He was very old. He was like 91 at that point. And he revealed himself to be Deep Throat. And he'd worked for the FBI for years and years and years. So and they made a film about him with Liam Neeson a few years ago, which wasn't very good, really. It was a bit iffy. But it was called something like Mark Felt, the man who was Deep Throat. So, it's not a secret anymore.
Now, that's on the nose.
Yeah, that's an on the nose title.
That is on the nose. Yeah, you're right. But no, it is a good title, and it's very, very evocative. That's true. What about the Jersey Devil then, moving on? I mean, that's obviously based on a real-life creature in this case. This is the first X-File to be named after a real-life legendary creature. In this case, the creature who's supposed to inhabit the Pine Barrens of South Jersey, known as a flying biped with hooves, which also described as a bipedal kangaroo-like or wyvern-like creature with a horse or goat-like head, leathery bat-like wings, horns, small arms with clawed hands, legs with cloven hooves, and a forked tail. Now, Very different from the Jersey Devil we get in the episode.
Yeah, I feel like it's a bit mean, to be honest. <In this case. laughs> Like, she was just a really tall woman who lived in the wild.
Yeah.
Well, but that's the thing. It's the X-Files, I guess, appropriating a real-life legend that is quite different. In this case, much more of a creature, sort of associated with all kinds of mythological sort of stuff, and then turning it into, in this case, a sort of the Neanderthal woman that we see in the X-Files mythology.
I wonder if this is the first time that the X-Files has taken something like... I think it is, in fact, the first time that the X-Files has taken someone like a Neanderthal woman living in the forest. Obviously, she must have a mate because she has children and stuff. It's very close to a urban city, and so therefore it's automatically become the other. Like, the title is The Jersey Devil. There's no suggestion that this woman is anything similar to us at all. And then you see that again with Darkness Falls, that theme of, you know, the division between the other of what exists in nature and then the urban civilization, and then you see it again in Home. And this might be the very first time it crops up in the season, and the episode title really clearly says this X-File that we're investigating is not like us. And then you see her and she's just a very tall woman. Or so I think that's quite an interesting setup there, the expectations you have versus what you end up seeing.
I think actually you make an excellent point there, Eddie. I think that the point I had was something more, I mean, early on in the X-Files run, I remember when I kind of like, it was very hyped and people started talking about it in my kind of like social circles, there was always this kind of like, well, it's all inspired by real cases. These things are actually going on, which obviously for most of it, of course, it isn't. But I think that there might be something in that title actually tying into some sort of, you know, folklore or some kind of legend where you can at least still play into that perception that there is inspiration here. It's not just, you know, plucked out of the minds of the writers. It is actually something that is inspired by something.
That's the key, I think, in that it's very deliberately, and I suppose in a way that's similar to Deep Throat, in that it's picking on aspects of American mythology and transforming them into the X-Files style without actually doing an episode about, which they could have easily done. They could have easily done an episode about the actual Jersey Devil, certainly paranormal enough. Yeah. And I mean, it's a similar sort of legend in some ways to stuff like the Mothman. And I always wondered why the X-Files never did an actual Mothman episode. And maybe it's because they did variations on these kind of creature stories. But the problem is, when you have a creature, it's hard to characterize, I suppose, something like that. If you'd have tried to create that wyvern-like beast, you would have had to eventually have had maybe some human villain involved, some scientist or some person, and it would have made it maybe a bit more sci-fi. So to actually have your monsters be a little bit more human in a way, I guess, and I suppose that's one of the reasons you have the memorable monsters are people like Tombs, or they're people like Pusher, and they're actual, even if they don't say a lot, they're human, and they're sort of twisted monster versions of humans, whereas something like this is a bit too out there.
I kind of like that the X-Files never did, or to my memory, did twist, they took a concept and did their own twist on it. So they did that with Big Blue, it wasn't Nessie. They didn't do a Bigfoot episode as such, but they referenced it in the revival that he goes Sasquatching, and you know, arguably Jersey Devil has shades of Bigfoot. So I kind of like that they took themes and urban legends that we're all familiar with and shone new angles on them, because it's good. It's refreshing storytelling and it's intriguing, and it just shows the creativity of the writers too.
So let's move on to the next one then, which is Ghost in the Machine, which it's a bit of a rubbish episode, I think, but the title is quite good.
Yeah.
And it's based, in fact, I mean, it's a well-known phrase now, the Ghost in the Machine. It's sort of become, I guess it was probably famous before this episode. It's not just the X-Files that's popularised this, but it gave it a little bit of a boost, I guess, in some ways. But it's based primarily on a book from 1967 about philosophical psychology by Arthur Koestler. It's a phrase coined by the Oxford philosopher Gilbert Ryle to describe the Cartesian dualist account of the mind-body relationship. In the book, Koestler shares with Ryle the view that the mind of a person is not an independent non-material entity temporarily inhabiting and governing the body, And the work is all about, it explains humanity's self-destructive tendency in terms of individual and collective functioning, philosophy, and overarching cyclical political historical dynamics peaking in the nuclear weapons era. Wow, that's a lot.
That's certainly everyone?
More than you get in the episode. Yeah, it's obvious. Did you get that, guys? Shall I repeat?
I've read it down here on the side. That's all very... No.
Yeah, it's a lot. Yeah. And I suppose from that, you know, if you're looking, it's whether or not they just saw that title and went, oh, that's good, we'll use that for a title about a weird AI thing, or that they went for a little bit more linked to the book in terms of the Cartesian idea that, you know, from Descartes about the spiritual side of the body and the mind being very different and to the physical body and all of these different ideas that's there in Descartes' work. I suspect it's more that they wanted to create the idea of a haunted AI,
yeah.
That would go, Brad. I'm not sure they were looking at the philosophical stuff as much, but I don't know what you guys think.
No, I don't know. I actually thought so this is one example, and I think there are several. There's going to be some example of this where the title is more interesting than the episode. Let's just be honest. I mean, Ghost in the Machine is pretty forgettable.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I mean, being a science fiction fan as I am, there was something about this title that even back then seemed to me to be a sort of mid-early 90s cyberpunk reference. And there is something in sci-fi writing about this whole concept of AI, of course, but also the mind and the body and can we transfer minds. And I mean, it's been used, either that title or, you know, variations of the title have been used a lot. I'm an enormous fan of the anime from, I think, 1995, The Ghost in the Shell, which is, of course, not the same title, but still drawing on some of the same connotations, also thematically. And here I'm, of course, talking about the anime, not the horrible Hollywood version released a couple of years ago. Let's forget about that.
That wasn't good.
So I thought when I did the research that they had actually perhaps delved into the whole mind and body aspect of it. But on the other hand, they might also just go, you know, it's a ghost in a machine. I'm not sure.
I think it is a cool title, and I really like the idea of something kind of spiritual and on that metaphysical plane, intermingling with a machine, which is obviously very technical and kind of man-made and so on. And I like the juxtaposition of those two ideas. But I feel like, again, it is making a comment on that, because AI is essentially taking, I guess, a form of consciousness. I don't know what the technical term would be, but putting it inside a machine. And so there's the literal ghost in the machine there, but also commenting on our destructive tendencies. Like, is this very act of creating artificial intelligence ultimately going to lead to our destruction? Because in this episode, it wants power for its own sake, it seems, and, you know, destroys anyone who gets in the way. And right now, you know, we participate in things like Alexa, in Facebook that we know aren't, you know, Facebook is not using our data for good, and yet we still participate. And so arguably, you know, we are contributing to our own destruction, and it's and this AI theme is very prevalent today. And I have a soft spot for this episode, because I like the way that where we are now. You can look back to this 30-year-old episode and see how we've got to where we are, but through the ideas that were kicking around 30 years ago. I think plus, I just love it when Scully falls over in the elevator. Very big piece of acting from her.
That's the peak moment. Well, I mean, to be fair, Brad Wilczek is kind of like a Zuckerberg-y kind of figure, isn't he? He's one of those genius, socially awkward, rather abrupt and weird and annoying people who are now jetting off into space, or creating these vast mega corporations, you know, these weird man children kind of, you know, uber nerds who now seem to have billions of dollars and this kind of thing. So in that sense, the X-Files was maybe slightly ahead of the curve in understanding that these were the people who were going to create the stuff that is going to basically rule. And it's all algorithm based, as you say. You know, it is that whole thing about, I mean, I was a bit freaked out. I was listening to the Economist podcast last week, and they were talking about how Zuckerberg wants to... Well, Zuckerberg was not on there, but it was a recording from a news thing he was doing, talking about how he wants Facebook to create what he called the metaverse. Sounds a bit like Marvel with the multiverse. It's not. It wouldn't surprise me if that was a name of his, but no, the metaverse is this idea that Facebook will be everything you do. In a way, I think it translates to something along the lines of what you saw in Ready Player One. I don't know if you guys have read that book or seen that movie.
I've seen the movie.
But and the idea is essentially that everyone in there is living through this VR portal called the Oasis, which you can do everything in. You can play games, you can go to school, you can explore planets, like, and they wither away in their human bodies on a devastated Earth, and they just plug this thing in and a mega corporation controls this game. And that, I've always thought that that actually in some ways might actually be where things like Facebook eventually go, you know, through algorithms, through AI, essentially controlling us through making the world about them and through them. It's freaky stuff, and let's hope that it doesn't happen, because it's terrifying, really. Yeah, so I think maybe Ghost in the Machine is not as getting into all this as such, but I think maybe, yeah, there is. It's more of a, I suppose it's the first sort of literary title that the show does in alluding to a text that's beyond just a paranormal idea. So in that sense, I suppose it's quite interesting, really. And maybe that episode, maybe we should give it a bit more credit.
Yeah, I think actually also when Eddie mentioned it, she made an excellent point. I mean, I think there are so many X-Files episodes, and that's, I guess, one of the reasons the show holds up so well. There are so many of the episodes that even though they're so old now, they actually, the topics or the themes are highly relevant even today, and this certainly is, and I think Ellie made an excellent point there. That another comment I wanted to make on this was just that the whole it's such a cyberpunk title, as it is in a way also a very cyberpunk episode. And of course, obviously, I would immediately think of someone like William Gibson, who wrote Neuromancer, who would actually later write a couple of episodes or co-write a couple of episodes for the show Killswitch, which was so hyped. Like, this was at the height of the popularity. And I just remember William Gibson is writing an episode of The X-Files. It's insane, at least in the nerd circles I was in.
And then he did First Person Shooter.
Yeah.
But no, you're right. I think it is quite cyberpunky. It is in that vein. I think all of this is far more interesting than anything in that episode, which is quite telling. But no, let's move on then and talk a little bit about the things in a way we haven't covered, because obviously I'm skipping over a few. And that's things like Conduit, Shadows, Ice, Space, Fire, to come, Shapes, Born Again later in the season. These are episodes that are interesting in their own right, some terrible, some brilliant, and most of them in between, I would say. But I suppose the reason I'm skipping over them is because they're very prosaic titles that feel like they could be on any show. You know,
yeah.
They feel like you could have put them in a Star Trek, or you could have put them in a Supernatural, or you could have put them in, you know, anything at that time, of that era or beyond. They're very bland. But I mean, am I doing them a disservice in that sense? Is there something to the fact that they're quite elemental titles? You know, these ideas of different elements, fire, ice, shadow, shape, that is maybe worth thinking about a bit more? Or is it just that they could have been a bit more inventive, you know, with some of these earlier titles?
Honestly, personally, I don't understand at all. I mean, I wrote a 5-minute treatise on the meaning of the title Space in connotation with the episode. No, I didn't.
I'm disappointed, Jonas, now.
I think a lot of these titles is exactly as you say. There's not much to say, right? All right, the episode is named Shadows. Okay, get it. Fire. Yes, it's about something with fire. Fine, right? So I haven't done a lot of thinking on those specific titles, other than what you just said.
I quite like the punchiness of them. I prefer titles like that, and I always like the title of Blood again, which I know is season two. But the ones that are just punchy and short and thematic and atmospheric, I prefer them to titles like Syzygy or Tithonus, or ones that are quite inaccessible and don't give you anything away. So at least with those titles, you can get the vibe. And I just want to make a really quick comment on Squeeze, which we haven't referred to yet. I know Squeeze is obvious because obviously it's Tombs and he squeezes and stretches. But I think it's interesting. I always think of Squeeze, even though it's episode 3, is being almost sandwiched in between the pilot and Deep Throat, because they're often taken together. You've got the pilot, you've got the first myth arc, and then you've got the first Monster of the Week. And I feel like it's almost squeezed into that spot by virtue of being the first monster of the week. But also it's where Scully is at. She's being squeezed by her allegiance and her assignment with Mulder, and her allegiance and history and ambition, you know, with the rest of the wider FBI. And so I think there's, for a shorter, seemingly light title, I think you can also draw a lot of themes if you are someone to think about things a lot, like I am.
No, that's really interesting. I wouldn't have thought of it in those terms. That's fascinating. Yeah, on multiple levels there, that's working as a title. Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah. Oh, I wish I hadn't said anything now, but I was just going to make a really cheap crack at saying the episode Fire, of course, has Mulder's old flame in it and they have a kiss. And it's very, very hot and fiery. But please edit this out. I'm cringing now.
No, that's staying in. No, that's good. That is good. That is good, because that episode is absolutely winking at things like this. You know, that episode has an absolute tongue-in-cheek Fire. You know, I don't know how anyone could watch Fire and take that completely seriously, any of it. Like, it is ridiculous. Like, it is Mulder's fear of fire that he never has again in 11 seasons. You know, it's Phoebe Green, who is just a character that basically ported out of Arthur Conan Doyle and given an update. You know, it's ridiculous. No, that's true. She isn't a flat. And this is the thing, right? I think some of these titles, I agree, Ellie. I think there is something to the punchiness of something like Ice. I Ice is a great episode anyway, but I quite like the simplicity of that. You know, you could have called it the Other, or, you know, or you couldn't call it The Thing, obviously. But I think it just gets to the point. I think the one I'm sad about is that they didn't go with, they've had Ghost in the Machine. They should have had, for space, Ghost Outside the Ship. You know,
yes.
I like it.
You got better two-part.
I love it.
There's a ghost outside the ship. That's my favourite line. It's interesting, I think, and you know, there are some more of these prosaic titles, but I think there is something to the punchiness of them. I do quite like the ones that it's a bit, what the hell does that mean? But sometimes they are a bit dense. You're right. And intentionally trying to trip you up with pronunciation as well. I mean, I've heard syzygy pronounced about 10 different ways over the years. So there is something to a simple title. What about Fallen Angel then? That's the 10th episode of the season. This obviously is a fairly run-of-the-mill, semi-myth arc story that's, before they sort of figured out what the myth arc was, it's a, you know, an alien story, crashed UFO. Back in the days, X-Files was doing fairly basic alien stories before they really started to stitch it all together. But obviously this is the first real biblical influence in the X-Files titles. Because, you know, the UFO has fallen from the sky and he's being recovered, but the fallen angel obviously goes back to the Abrahamic religion's term, which isn't actually in the Bible, but it's a description of angels cast out of heaven and angels who've sinned. Obviously, the big one being the big old bad Lucifer himself, Satan. So it's in the idea of that these angels then try and tempt humans into sinning, and this kind of, you know, mythological idea that goes back to Christian religion. Is this obviously seems to be intentional on the part of Chris Carter? Is it an early example of the kind of things we will much later see in titles and episodes such as Gethsemane, or particularly the Biogenesis trilogy, in those ideas of ancient astronauts and the end, you know, the ancient astronauts idea. Even though it isn't directly about that kind of subject matter, are we already starting to see that layered into the X-Files here?
I couldn't figure out what Fallen Angel refers to in the episode, and In full disclosure, it's not one of my favourites, so I haven't. It's not one that I've rewatched a lot. But like, I wondered if it referred to maybe Mulder, because this is also, I believe, the first time they refer to closing the X-Files, and so I wondered if it was like his complete journey from Golden Boy profiler down to now. Yes, he's literally in the basement. he's gone down, and now, you know, his work is such a threat that they want to just shut it down. And I wonder if it's a title that refers to how his professional journey has gone as a result of his personal quest. And I also thought it was interesting that a show that, or an episode that doesn't overtly refer to particularly Christian themes is called Fallen Angel, whereas something like Biogenesis and Biogenesis 2, which does overtly refer to particularly Christian themes at times, has a particularly scientific title. So I thought that that was an interesting sort of parallel there.
I'm really very much in line with what you just said, Ellie. I think when I looked at the title of this episode, I had a little bit of a hard time finding out, is there an actual connection? Is there an actual context here? Who is the fallen angel? Is, I mean, seeing as the fallen angel is something that is going to tempt mankind. So who is it then? Is it the alien? Is it the is it Mulder? Is it Max? I think it's a little hard to find the context there, other than being, of course, an interesting title. And I mean, later on, the X-Files would delve into these topics. There's also an episode which has a special meaning to me that I actually really, really like, is All Souls, that would come much later in the fifth season, which also deals with some of these topics.
I think, you know, there's quite... I mean, we've got another biblical one coming up this season in a little while, but yeah, there are quite a few. And I always find it interesting when they're tethered to alien stories. I think that's great. You're making great points there, Ellie, in terms of what you're unpicking. And I think you can definitely read it that way. I saw it on a basic level that the fallen angel is the UFO, and that it is the alien come to Earth, and that there is an attempt to sort of conflate the alien to this idea of something coming to tempt Mulder or these characters or the army or whatever. But it isn't very clear. And to be fair, this kind of title works much better, I think, in something like Gethsemane, where you can pick out the allusions in terms of Mulder's quest and the, you know, the ideas behind that, which obviously much later on in this title journey we will get to eventually. But I think it works better in that kind of context. Whereas you could have called Fallen Angel something like Crash, if you really want it to be really boring, or you know, or something, you know, you could have gone with something very, very simple again, or something else. It didn't have to have a biblical reference, because there isn't really anything else in the episode that sort of alludes to that, really, as far as I can remember.
Ghost in the Woods, isn't that the episode where there's a scene where it was running around invisible in the woods?
Yeah. The Predator moment, yeah, you're right. The ghost in the... Yeah, this is a theory, right? We should try and find ghost in there for every single episode.
Yeah.
So you have ghost in the ice, ghost in the... A much better episode than Fallen Angel is Beyond the Sea, which comes next. I think universally sort of recognised as one of the great X-Files episodes generally, maybe the best episode of season one. And the title itself comes from a song, the song Beyond the Sea, first written by Charles Trenet from the song La Mer, which was a song recorded in French in 1945. And it was reconfigured for a songwriter called Jack Lawrence in around the same era, just at the end of the war. And then the particular one that is in this episode and is referenced is probably what has become the most famous, which is Bobby Darin's version from 1959. And that has sort of continued on through the era. It's been recorded by plenty of other people, but it's all of these kind of great sort of old school, you know, easy listening sort of singers have done this. But this is, the Bobby Darin one is particularly famous. And I mean, it's I suppose it's a bit of a juxtaposition, isn't it, between the real darkness of this episode and something that is characterised more particularly with a... I mean, it's played, isn't it, over Scully's dad's funeral. So, but it's something that is maybe particularly a little bit more designed to be quite uplifting. I don't know. It feels like there's a juxtaposition at play here with the use of that, with some very, very dark themes and some strange ideas.
First of all, this is one of my absolute favorite episodes. I love this episode. I think it has memorable performances by Dourif. It's Morgan and Wong at their best. And having just rewatched Millennium Season 2 and the connection with Bobby Darin, I know that's a topic for another podcast, so I won't go there, but of course he's very much on my mind. But I love everything about this episode. And if you think about the lyrics of the song and how it's played over the funeral of the father, and it is in many ways a very dark episode, but in some ways there is also something a little bit uplifting to the end because Scully decides not to get the message from the character that Dewey plays. I forget what the character's name is. And it is also a song about how the loved ones are waiting for us somewhere. They are on the other side. And in some ways, that's the choice she makes. It is, you know what? I am going to get there. I am going to see him again somewhere at a later point. That's always been at least my kind of like perception of that ending, that she's making that active choice. She does not need this message, and she will see him again somehow.
That's such a nice interpretation. I hadn't thought of it that way before. For me, the scene where Maggie Scully explains this history behind the song and their association with it is just, it's so romantic, and my heart just breaks for her. You know, she's saying goodbye to her life partner, and I feel like she, in those few lines she has, she just conveys such a history. So that, for that moment alone, like that, every time I think of that song, it just reminds me of like a marriage that they had 40 years or however. And it's literally, that's the first time we see Maggie Scully and I'm already like weeping for her. But I also thought Beyond the Sea is an interesting phrase because we come to learn how much of an influence Scully's dad was in her life, and this is the start of that, you know, her seeking his approval, needing to know if he approved of her choices. We see it in Never Again, we see it in One Breath, and this is the episode where now she has to look beyond the sea. You know, her Ahab is gone, and what is beyond the sea? And what's beyond the sea is her freedom, or the weight's off her shoulders now, and she can pursue her life as she wants, and she can fully commit to a career in the X-Files, and then, you know, it becomes her personal quest as well. But this is the episode where she can finally look beyond the sea, beyond her dad and his expectations and the weight of that.
Yeah, I think those are great interpretations. And I suppose that's, you know, where the character of Luther Lee Boggs, comes in, because he's essentially that, in theory, what you're saying is true, he's that conduit to beyond the sea. But it is a great sort of allusion to Scully's quest here, in a way, to try and think beyond what she would normally think. And this is the first and one of the best examples of that, I think, the show ever did, really, so early on. But no, it's I'm glad you brought up, though, Jonas, the Millennium thing, because that is key, because Morgan and Wong obviously then write season two of Millennium, a lot of it, and they bring Bobby Darin in as a point of interest for Frank Black, and you get Bobby Darin songs creep in many of those episodes in season two, again as a juxtaposition, in that you've got Bobby Darin, this big band guy who obviously tragically died very young, before in like the late 1950s, I think it was, or the early 1960s, and it is a great juxtaposition, really, using these kind of songs and bringing that in. So it's clear Morgan and Wong were fans and they wanted to introduce this kind of music back into this world. So, yeah, but it works particularly well here. And, yeah, some great interpretations there, guys, I think. Really, really interesting stuff. Let's talk a bit about Gender Bender. This title. Well, this episode in general, I mean, like, this is a very clear example, isn't it, of an X-File I don't think would get made today, really, for many reasons. Yeah. And I think this title is difficult now, isn't it, really? With our modern hindsight and the acceptance of particularly the trans community and the LGBTQ community, I think Gender Bender, it just doesn't sit well. It doesn't with me anyway. It's not about you guys.
No, I agree. I wrote in my notes, I think I put, not so much clever to say here. I guess, well, yeah, it's tied to what the Monster of the Week does in this episode. I totally agree, this episode would not be made today. It hasn't aged well, it's aged terribly. I did look up, try and find a definition of the term, because I was actually thinking about where does this term actually come from? And I found somewhere where it said, a person who defies or challenges traditional notions of gender, especially with respect to dress or behavior. And I guess if that's the definition, it has more sympathetic connotations than the actual episode does.
Yeah. I feel like what they did with that concept is the harmful thing. I don't want to speak on behalf of anybody. So first of all, that's there. But I was also doing some research, and in terms of LGBT plus representation in the media in the early 90s, it wasn't as prevalent as it is today. And so Friends caused a big splash when they had the lesbian wedding, and that was 1996. Ellen had her puppy episode in 97, and this was filmed in 1993. So this is early days. And I fully acknowledge its place now, and what it, you know, the connotations of the episode and so on. But it was in a time when this shows like this had to ask these questions in order to get to the point where we are today. And now we can look back and say, well, actually, your messaging here is not good and not positive. But I feel like it has a place in the history of getting to where we are today. And now we're here, we can look back and say that it's not good. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Because I am a firm believer that we should never completely erase problematic things from the past. We should lay, you know, I'm a big fan of, we, you know, when you have comedies with, you know, racial content or sexual content or whatever that's beyond, you know, the times, behind the times, that you put a warning on. You just say this has stuff that is from a previous era, you know, and then you let people make their own mind up. I'm a firm believer of that. I do not think censorship because we, like you say, Ellie, we need to learn from things. We need to look back at something like Genderbender and go, that wasn't really okay, but I understand from the time why that was made and how now you would do a story like that. If you were going to do it, you would do it very differently. And I think much more sensitively and much more appropriately. So no, I agree. I think that's great. I think that's important. I think it's important to recognise that things were very different then. The approach to the trans community and these kind of ideas, and it's the sort of thing I imagine when they wrote this, they weren't even really thinking of. You know, they were thinking about a sex change alien being or whatever it is. And do you know what I mean? I don't think they would have really thought in the depth of the, because people didn't, did they, back then in the same way? The general populace just didn't do it.
I remember when I watched it. I was a child when I watched it and when it came out. And it was, I remember among my peers, it was one of the really exciting ones. I was like, oh my goodness, have you seen this show? There's a show, there's an episode where you can change genders. And it was, for me, I actually think it was probably the first introduction to that I ever had. And now you look back and you see all these other elements which are harmful by today's standards. But back in the day, that was the first stepping stone to that concept or to that reality. And so, yeah, I agree with you, Tony.
No, and I agree with you. I agree with both. Yeah, I agree with both. And totally. I mean, but to me, it is actually a quite memorable episode. I mean, I remember this episode from, I don't particularly like it. And it was not like I thought it was very, very great that time, but it did make an impression. I do remember it from back then, from the first watch.
It's a hard one to forget, really. I mean, I think it just about passes for me for two reasons. One, the ending, which I've always loved, the what the hell kind of twist at the end with the crop circle. I love that. I still love that. And also the fact that when we talked about it way, way back on the X-Cast, this was the episode that gave birth to Dave Krychek. So for that alone, it passes. You know,
I'm going to have to listen to that.
You wouldn't have the David train without this.
I have been wondering about that origin story, so I'm going to have to go and listen to that episode now.
Yeah,
me too. It's myself and Wayne Talbot, way, way back, like this was something like 2016. That was the birth of Dave Krychek. So yeah, do go back and listen to that, guys, because it spawned a monster.
Nice one. And then I'll be a fully paid member of the Davy train. I'll be a full passenger.
You will. Yeah, you'll be on the Davy train for sure. And then you can, you know, go and, like everyone else, go and explore the amazing spin-off show to the X-Files that people have never heard of, you know. So if lots of people listen to this and going, what's the Davy train? Google it, guys. But you won't find anything. It's all... Anyway, that's a whole separate discussion. Lazarus then, I suppose, is the next biblical reference on the X-Files. This is a more well-known one, I guess. You know, Lazarus being the resurrection figure. Lazarus of Bethany or Saint Lazarus in the Gospel of John. Jesus restores Lazarus to life 4 days after his death. And it's a very well-known text, I think, within Christian mythology. And in this case, obviously, it is imported into an episode which is the soul swapping episode, isn't it? It's the Jack Willis, the FBI agent, gets the soul of the dead criminal, and then he takes over his body. I mean, what do you think? Does this, because there isn't really any Christian context to such in this beyond maybe Scully's faith, but I don't know. Do you think this is a title that he's really earned for this episode in particular?
I like the episode, but I agree, no.
No. I mean, yes, there is someone who comes back to life in a way, and there is a resurrection taking place in a way. That's it. I don't think the thinking around the title has gone much deeper than that.
Yeah.
But I do like the episode as well. I think it's a quite good episode.
I think it's the soul swapping element that kind of changes the dynamic of the story a little bit. And I also feel like a concept like Lazarus, like that could be a really cool X-Files. And they do explore it in a couple of episodes later on, like Kaddish. And then, you know, there's that little storyline in Jesuit that I love.
And also Hollywood AD as well. There's a little bit of the idea of that in the clay as well in Hollywood
AD. Exactly. But this is not that. This is, as you say, soul swapping. And yeah, I agree. They probably thought this is the theme. Let's call it that. It's another one where it gives you a clue as to what it's going to be about, but it's not closely linked enough.
It just feels a little bit like Carter at this point wants to bring in that biblical Christian mythology into the X-Files, but he doesn't really know where and how, because it's still quite a procedural, it's still finding its feet, it's still quite a procedural paranormal show. It's doing these maybe far more obvious kind of storylines that you get in a lot of science fiction shows. You know, the soul swapping, the fallen UFO, the parasite worm, you know, all these things. You know, you get a lot of these kind of stories in different science fiction shows of the era. So maybe... The idea is there that will be properly and much better explored later, but it's a bit wedged in at this point, I think, titles wise. Young at Heart, we kind of tethers a little bit to Beyond the Sea, in that it reminded me the most of the song Young at Heart by Frank Sinatra, not just Frank Sinatra, but other, you know, other again. The episode is a bit of a weird one. It's the one with John Barnett and the salamander hand and all that genetic stuff. It's you know, Mulder's Joker, they wanted to sort of suggest. It's just an odd episode. But I don't know, did you guys feel there was anything else? I just thought of the song, the song Young at Heart. Did you guys feel there was anything else in that episode that the title was referring to or was in particular interest?
Am I right in thinking, maybe I'm misremembering, but isn't the title... Isn't it the opposite of what happens? Like, he's not young at heart. he's an old man in a young body. So that's like the opposite of young at heart.
Yeah. Because it's the rapid aging progeria, isn't it? It's the genetics of that that he's brought in. Yeah.
And when they meet John Barnett in at the time of the episode, he's not the old man that he was at the trial. So like he's young in body and old in heart.
Yeah. So there's an irony to it.
I really like this episode. I know it's not the best, but I love the lines. Fox can't guard the chicken coop. I love the fact that he's been stalked at the kids' football game. It's what, honestly, I think it's It's top. It's one of the top 10 for me. I really like this episode. Yeah, I think so. Wow, but okay. I think I have associations of watching it as a child and being like, oh, wow, this is good, you know?
Yeah. That's okay. I've just not heard it like that much by anyone else before. That's good. That's a new approach. That's great. That's really good.
Maybe that's a suggestion for a patron, like the what do people love that they really shouldn't?
Yeah. That would be a good one. Yeah, we should do that. Let's talk about EBE, because it feels like EBE, I mean, that's a much more famous myth arc story, obviously, and involves Deep Throat and the first Lone Gunman and all these things. EBE is a very memorable episode. The title obviously stands for Extraterrestrial Biological Entity. Now, I don't know about you, this felt like the first time that title was sort of that acronym was sort of popularized, because it's something that is there in UFO lore. You know, the idea of the EBE, going back to Roswell and all these things, you know, these famous crash incidents. And I guess this episode is kind of that. It's kind of wanting to play on some of that Roswell mythology that then factors into the X-Files much more deeper later. I don't know. I think it's a good title, because I think it's alluding to something that is there if you know a lot of the real life sort of mythology around ufology, but wasn't necessarily at the time in the popular consciousness. Whereas I think after this, it's a little bit more of a well-known acronym in that sense.
I had exactly that note down. I was actually going to ask you guys if you knew if this acronym was actually used anywhere before this episode, because to me, that title is always such a standout. It's like I always have to remind myself, EBE, oh yeah, that's that extraterrestrial biological entity. And as a kid, I grew up with other abbreviations like ET or from the Spielberg movie or other things, but I've never heard this abbreviation outside of this episode, actually. So I think that is an excellent point you raise. Was this popularized by this episode, or did it become a little bit more well known and only used in smaller circles? I simply don't have the knowledge, and I was curious if you guys did.
I haven't heard EBE like referred in pop culture or otherwise very much, but I think the show is incredibly it has a very powerful role to play in just making these concepts more familiar to people. So I think extraterrestrial biological entity is probably more familiar with people than EBE, but I agree that this is maybe the first time this show takes something that only a small circle would know and widens it and brings it to the masses.
It does, I've not found any specifics on the origins of this necessarily, and you know, if people know about this who are listening, please let us know, you know, on the basement or in comments or whatever. You know, please inform us, because I haven't come across, you know, the origin as such. I think it's quite prevalent in some of the cultural ideas behind ufology and alien mythology in, you know, going back many years. But yeah, it's something that I feel like we've probably seen more subsequently, or heard more subsequently after the X-Files, the extraterrestrial biological entity. I'd not really seen it come across anywhere else before, so I think it sort of gave a name to things that were already there, and we were seeing in you know, like you say, things like Close Encounters and all these kind of things, but actually giving it some sort of definition, I guess, in a way, and something that's very deliberately sort of governmental, scientific, official, I guess. You know, I mean, the big standout scene, really, of the episode is the final one with Mulder and Deep Throat, isn't it? Where he sort of gives him the option to have a look, and he it's not there, and it's that bit. So I feel like it's that, and he mentions EBE, and he talks about the history of it and the crash and how there was a government decision made and all of this internal sort of mythology. So yeah, I think it's really interesting how it sort of gives this a name, something we can hang on to, an EBE. I think it does the show good, actually. Really,
I agree. I think, is this the one where they realise that their pen is being bugged? Is this the one where she opens up the pen in the office? Yeah, and so I like the way it's a very explicit link, isn't it? Extremely explicit link between the concept of EBEs and the concept of government conspiracy. Like this builds on Fallen Angel, and you can see exactly where it's heading. Now that we've got the perspective of the whole 11 seasons, you can see what a foundational building block this is. And I guess I hadn't really thought about the how intriguing it is that you have a title of EBE, which is one thing, and then the show is all about government conspiracies and so on, and the link, the explicit link between those two.
Yeah, and I think also the title is relevant. Just leaning on what you just said, Eddie, it's also such a relevant title based on how much the specific EBE means to Mulder, right? That he really wants that last scene is always so memorable to me, or late in the episode when he's trying to look into the box where the alien has been kept, and kind of like Deep Throat is preventing him from going there. That is the episode, right? Or am I?
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, that's the end. Yeah.
And where that EBE just means so much for Mulder's search for the truth. So the title is just so relevant in so many aspects.
Yeah, it's almost like the MacGuffin. It's that thing that he can get to prove the truth, and it just turns out to be smoke and mirrors as usual. But now, yeah, really good episode, very interesting title. What about Darkness Falls? That's that one. I mean, it's a really good episode anyway. That's the bacteria kind of things in the trees that sort of swarm and eat you, the bugs. Yeah, it's great, really good episode. I think that's a really good title. It's not. I think it could in some senses be considered a bit more functional, but I think it's very evocative. You know, it could mean anything. It doesn't really necessarily tether to bugs in trees, but I think what I picked up was that it could be sort of an ominous indication of where things are going for Mulder. If we're building on this idea that the fallen angel of Mulder is going to face a crisis as he gets towards the end of the season, maybe Darkness Falls is one of those ominous indications of what we then later see in Tombs, that a change is coming.
Oh, interesting. I hadn't thought about it like that. Because the episode itself is very claustrophobic. And this idea, it's almost like this, the idea of like the net's closing in on you, Mulder. Like the darkness is coming.
Mm.
You're going to have your... You're going to have your reckoning at the end of the season.
And I mean, on the functional basis, it is that when it gets dark, the bugs swarm. So I understand on a basic level why it's called that, obviously. But yeah, I felt like it could be that. It could be a little bit of leaning into that idea that. And I mean, I always feel like the ending of that episode where they barely get out alive has always haunted me a little bit, because that felt like one of the closest points they come to actually dying on a case. And I think that's brilliant. The idea that if they don't stop these bugs, it could be the end of everything. Like, if forget alien conspiracies and all this kind of thing. Those bugs, if they multiplied and got free, how do you stop them? You know, I think it's quite an ominous ending to the episode as part of that.
Yeah. It's a read. I hadn't caught on it. And I actually hadn't taken any notes on that. I didn't think deeper about that title preparing for this. But I think you make just a good point there that it might actually also lead into something ominous and actually be well thought out in context of what's going to happen right around the corner.
The title is another one of those ones which gives you an indication of what to expect in the episode. And as you said, Tony, it's one of the closest episodes that they come to actually dying on a case. And it's also one of the very, very, very few episodes where you see Scully feeling really, really outside her comfort zone and vulnerable. And so it's a really uncomfortable episode. And the title is just... I feel like it's a horror movie, you know, and Darkness Falls, the title, really plays into that nicely, I think. And I love the idea that our end could just come from bugs, you know, and here we have, like you say, you know, it's not aliens, it's not huge government conspiracies or technological advances. It's we chop a tree down and let loose a whole load of bugs.
Yeah. Yeah. Terrifying. It's funny you should say a horror film, Ellie, though, because actually the title was used. Now, this is interesting because there's an interesting X-Files connective here. The title was used for a supernatural horror film in 2003 called Darkness Falls, about a guy who witnesses his mother's murder at the hands of a vengeful spirit lynched by an angry mob years 100 or so years ago. Very different story, but the writer of that, the co-writer of that film, is Joe Harris, who wrote the season 10 and 11 X-Files comics. And he has been on this podcast before.
So
I would put money on that title being because Joe Harris remembered it from the X-Files.
Yeah.
And he called it Darkness Falls.
Yeah.
Can't prove it, but it's a theory. It's a conspiracy, guys.
Okay. Just gonna dig a little deeper.
Yeah,
it's just proof that people from X-Files are actually, we are the conspiracy. We are the ones taking over, right? Yeah. Fans.
Yeah. We're gonna take over the world, and they won't even know it. We are the syndicate. As we begin to wrap up, let's talk about Tombs, because obviously we mentioned Squeeze earlier. You made that great point earlier about Squeeze. Tombs is more deliberately on the nose about a character that we know already. It's a unique episode in the sense that it's a sequel, and they only did, I think, two other examples of this. I think Kitsunagari and Orizon, where they brought back famous villains. I can't remember any other examples of this, but they didn't call them Pusher or Donnie, those episodes. You know, they still gave them different, more enigmatic titles, those sequels. Whereas this one, they call Tombs. And it very much feels like Tombs became so quickly such a banner character. You know, the one of the great X-Files villains. Even though he was only in two episodes in season one, he would be on a list of famous X-Files villains. Tombs would be maybe even the most famous. He would be up there in terms of monsters. Is this an example of how much Tombs already has sort of got into the inner mythology of the X-Files in terms of the impact, in that even in the first season, they name an episode after a villain?
I would say yes. And I also like Tombs because I like the episode title, because it really positions him at the center. Whereas with Squeeze, there's the mystery, they're trying to solve the case, they're trying to figure out what's going on. With Tombs, you know exactly what the X-Files going to be about, who's going to be in it, and who the central antagonist is going to be. And this is also like Pusher, it's like Young at Heart, where Tombs is positioned as Mulder's antagonist. You know, no one believes Mulder. He stands up in that courtroom where they're assessing whether or not Tombs can go free, and he sounds ridiculous, and no one believes him. And so he has to go to more desperate and desperate lengths to try and prove that he's right. And all the while he's just, you know, pushing himself to the sidelines. And I feel like that you get all that from the title. You know exactly what's going to happen. And I like it.
Yeah, and I think also perhaps I've always seen that title and bringing back the character so early and so quickly was perhaps also just a sign of them really finding their way. Like, he was a very successful character. Let's try and bring him back. And perhaps later on they decided that creatively they wanted to do that in different ways and not do it that often. But I think it is also just like a season one thing, right? Where you're trying something in a way, creative.
Yeah, that could be the case. Yeah, and it's I just find it very interesting that they didn't repeat that trick. I mean, obviously they call Pusher. Which, you know, best episode of the X-Files. just got to get that in there. It's not something they necessarily did all the time, especially for a sequel. So, yeah, it's really interesting points there. I think it's very interesting how it's almost like he's back. You know, it's that whole he's back. It's this big deal, you know. And then, you know, it's in counterbalance to an episode like Roland, where... That tells you nothing, doesn't it, really? It's hard to boil down that episode anyway. You know, you can't really do that in one log line, Roland. It's a weird one for that. But it doesn't give you any indication, whereas Tombs is slightly different.
Yeah, it is. And it almost seems like a horror anthology, right? Like, you know, I don't know, Freddy Krueger or some of those famous kind of like, where it's like, all right, we're bringing him back and we're naming the episode after him. And like, you know, it's like,
yeah.
I don't know, Freddy's Dead, or some of those immense amount of sequels that they did in the 80s on the good horror franchises. And it is, those two episodes do to me feel like very good horror in some ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're so creepy, those episodes.
Yeah. I want the third Tomb story. Tombs takes Manhattan. That's what I want.
Yes, Tombs takes Manhattan.
Yeah. Ghost in the Escalator.
Revenge of Tombs.
yeah, Ghost in the Escalator.
I'm halfway through the Orizon episode now, and actually Darren and Kurt are talking about it, the title of Orizon, and how everyone is here to see Faster, but but the episode is titled Orizon after Reverend Orizon. And I think I'm glad that they didn't title it Faster, and I'm glad they didn't title Kitsunagari Pusher or Modella or anything, because I don't, this is the best sequel in my opinion out of the three, and I think it earns its name, whereas in my head I don't have those two as official sequels to their originals, because they are too different, and certainly for Orison, yeah, it's not good enough. I like the pulpiness of Kitsunagari, but I'm not a fan of Orison, so in my head I kind of psychological think, well, they're not the real sequels anyway.
Yeah. I don't think you'd be alone there, to be honest.
Yeah.
but no, I think it's like you guys have been saying as well, it's the evocative nature of the name Tombs. You know, it sounds like a horror movie, a tomb, even though it's not the same thing. It's creepy. It's good title anyway for an X-Files episode, but it has extra deeper resonance. So yeah, it's good. And it is the better sequel out of the three. I mean, much as I do really like Kitsunagari, actually, and I talked about it on the podcast, yeah, this is the best sequel. Yeah, there's no getting away from that, really. But let's finish then by talking about the finale title, The Erlenmeyer Flask. It's a weird title for a finale, isn't it? In so many shows, you'll have something like, I don't know, Future's End, or The Journey's, you know, whatever, you know, something like that, or The Quest Ends, or, you know, something dramatic, whereas this, you get a flask, and it's like, right, okay. I mean, what do you guys think about this as a, it's a very weird, strange finale title, I think, isn't it? I mean, brilliant episode, but a weird title.
For me, when I saw your notes on it, I was like, yeah, that is true. I mean, just naming it after the archetypical kind of like lab flask you see in labs and all sorts of movies. But on the other hand, thinking back, when I just look at the titles and reminding myself about the episodes, it does help me remember a lot of kind of like the themes of that specific episode, which the DNA and the experimentation and the government experiments and the things that it really starts to open up here in a much deeper way. And it's such a brilliant episode. And I don't know, I think, yeah, it's not one of those, you know, apocalypse is coming titles, or, you know, the end of everything or something. But it is still evocative in its own X-Files way to the topics that are so central to the show in a way.
That's a really good point. And I was thinking about the Erlenmeyer flask, and for that particular piece of equipment, I was always in my education and stuff, we always referred to those kind of things as conical flasks rather than Erlenmeyer flask. So I think out of the two names, they definitely chose the more mysterious one rather than calling the episode conical flask.
Ellie, the conical flask, that would have been the greatest episode title ever. and then the season 2 premiere is called The Bunsen Burner. That's what it should have been.
I know.
The Bunsen
Burner. What a missed opportunity.
They should have named every premiere and finale after the season 2 finale should have been the Petri dish.
Yeah.
Just like so many. You could just...
But I really like how the whole episode, the whole season finale is named out of something that contains something that Scully makes a joke about monkey pee. And I think, again, as someone who likes to read into things fairly and find meaning that probably isn't there, but I like that it's just some random thing in a lab. And it's like it's like in Colony where they're just reading the newspaper and he picks up on an ad. It's like when they're chasing phantom tanker trucks. It's like when, you know, things are just happening on random train lines. It's just everyday things. And then they contain the secrets of the conspiracy. Plus the visual, I always remember Scully lifting the alien out of the freezer, which is not an Erlenmeyer flask.
Yeah.
But when you say that, that's the image that is conjured up, this whole scientific experimental thing.
It's mentioned again later on in things like as Two Fathers, One Son. You know, the Erlenmeyer flask gets mentions and things like that. You know, it's an important mythological thing for the X-Files mythos, the Erlenmeyer flask and what's in there. You know, it is eventually really important. So it's almost like Chris Carter sort of knew that beforehand. I mean, obviously the actual connotation is the real-life figure of Emil Erlenmeyer, who was a 19th-century German chemist who contributed the early development for the theory of structure, who formulated the Erlenmeyer rule, which is very complicated. It's full of science. I would encourage anyone to look on Wikipedia about it, because I'm not going to read it because it'll take me an hour. And he designed the Erlenmeyer flask, which was a type of specialized flask ubiquitous in chemistry laboratories. And it was named after him, as we say, the conical flask. So, you know, he is a real life person, Erlenmeyer. And I didn't know that until researching years later. But I like the fact it's about something scientific almost. It's not, it's the X-Files proving that it doesn't have to have these more conventional dramatic titles. I mean, we get one in season 2, Endgame, but it's not the finale. You know, you could have called this Endgame because it's the end of the X-Files for this point. You could have called this episode Endgame, but it wouldn't have meant the same thing. So I quite like the fact they're not afraid to throw something in there. It's like at the end of season 3, you get Talitha Kumi and you're like, what the hell does that mean? You've got to go and look it up, you know? So I like that about it. Yeah, it's a good thing that they do. And a lot of shows at that time weren't doing this. They weren't doing this kind of thing.
And just admit it, Tony. I mean, before, when you said you hadn't delved that deep into it, you did mention Robert Bunsen, right? And of course, that's because you were just throwing at our noses how you did the research. And actually, in 1855, Emil Erlenmeyer moved to work in Robert Bunsen's laboratory, right? That's just a callback you did there very offhandedly.
Of course, the Bunsen burner.
I can't believe the writers didn't pick that up. Like, that's just sloppy, if you ask me.
I mean, I obviously knew this, Jonas. You know, obviously, as you say, you know, it was obviously something I'd done deep research about.
Deep research.
Hence the connections, yeah. You know, I don't rely on Wikipedia at all, obviously.
No.
But yeah, I mean, I think we can all agree that the title of this episode really should have been Ghost in the Flask.
Yes. Yeah.
Just.
Hands down.
Easy. So yeah, that brings us to the end of season 1. We're going to leave it there. We're going to come back as a team and do season 2 at some point soon as another roundtable episode, because we've gone quite deep into these season 1 titles. Come up with some fascinating things I didn't know, readings on this I hadn't heard before. And it's been a real pleasure doing this with you guys, and I look forward to doing it again. So thank you so much for joining us for another roundtable and supporting the show in the way you do. It is so appreciated. It keeps the X-Cast going. So I hope you've enjoyed it, because I have, and I've learned so much about ghosts and flasks and space and all these things. So thank you. Thanks. It's been great to have you both on.
It's been great to be a part of it. Thank you for asking. It's so much fun.
Yeah, a big thank you from here as well. This has been so enjoyable and fun to talk about these topics with both of you guys, and I learned a lot of new things about also ghosts and everything. So thank you.
Guys, why don't you point people towards where they can find you if you're online, if you've got anything, you know, any websites or any social media or anything, if they want to follow you and see what else you're up to.
Yeah, so I am in the basement, happy to chat away about all kinds of things. And I also write fan fiction under the name of Tabitha Jean on AO3.
I don't do much, but I have recently tweeted about 1013 related things and other geeky stuff, and I can be found on at Jonas Wilstrup if people want to look me up on Twitter. But I'm not as active as a lot of the brilliant people in and around these podcasts here.
That's awesome though. People are going to want to find that. And Ellie, I'm really glad you're doing the writing stuff. That's brilliant. That's really glad.
Thank you.
Great you're doing that. That's awesome. So I'm sure, you know, people will go and seek you guys out. I hope you do. I encourage that, guys. You can obviously find me, as always, at AJ Black Writer. You'll find links to the rest of the We Made This Podcast Network at WMT_network and my own website, thetruthisinhere.co.uk, where I'm writing about various different things and my books and blah, 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 all that stuff. But thanks for joining us for another episode generally. Remember, we are part of the We Made This Podcast Network. Please subscribe to the X-Cast and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you want to help out our network, please consider supporting us on Patreon if you go to patreon.com/wemadethis, or you can join our XCast special Patreon, which we'll give you some details about in the credits if you hang on and listen. The X-Files is not all we're talking about, though, so we will give you a taste of what else you might have missed on the network in just a minute. But until then, remember, as always, trust no one.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
Between the Notes.
TV and film music podcast. It's a prequel to Natasha's death in Avengers Endgame, but it's also in between lots of other stories that we've already seen. And she reconnects with her Russian family, her Russian sister, played by Florence Pugh, and has to take on an evil...
yeah, good luck describing the villain in this one. Good luck. Yeah.
Called Dreykov, played by Ray Winston.
Yeah, he's slag.
He's doing the rush. He'll go, Natasha, shall we go down and get the girls from the Red Room?
That's a really good impression. That's exactly what he says.
He does. Giddy carousel of pop.
I was a big fan of Howard Jones at that point. I was actually in the Howard Jones fan club. It's very personal. His wife, I think, and his mum ran it, and you could write them all sorts of silly things, and they'd always send you a little postcard back. And I think they sent me a postcard once, and it had Howard signed on it in like silver marker pen. You know, like everything in the 80s was signed with silver marker pen. And I remember writing back to them saying, thank you for this. Did Howard really sign it? And they wrote back to me and like, yes, Howard did really sign it. I fancy going to all that trouble. And they're like, no. Yes, Howard did really sign it.
Observing the Pattern, a fringe podcast.
I think the complete opposite to seeing yourself represented would be to see yourself overrepresented and just have it lashed into your face that there's a disabled person on the screen. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, oh, look, this person's gay. We're going to tell you that he's gay every time he's on the screen. You know, that's not okay. Just let them be there, man. That's how it is in real life. They're just there.
Yeah.
You know, and I think she plays it very well.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at @X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the X-Cast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the X-Cast Pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at @WeMadeThisPod.
Thanks for listening and keep watching the skies.